So good morning. So today we'll continue this high performance optimization topic, broader topic we're looking at, and specifically we'll look at vector instructions and what are those. That's when we use an instruction and we compute an entire vector of on an arithmetic operation on an entire vector of operands. And we call that a single instruction, because it's just one instruction, one vector instruction, multiple data. There's more arguments. There's like a group of arguments. So it's multiple data. It's not just one argument you pass to the function, it's more. So that's why it's SIMD, single instruction, multiple data. All right. So let's start with just looking at the very simple code that we've seen before. We have two arrays of integer type, they're 512, size of 512 ints inside each of them. And then we have a for loop, and we just add each element from A with each element from B, and we store it into A, right? And we've seen before that we can make this somewhat faster, and the reason it's faster is, there is out of order, there is in parallel execution, and there is also that ratio of we have a higher ratio of what we compute to what we do for bookkeeping. We have the same amount of bookkeeping, but more actually work being done. So we unroll in this case by 8, so we increment the loop here by 8, right? And then we have an unroll of 8 of these additions, and this is the same thing. So the goal here is to use a vector instruction to do all of these 8 additions together. Questions so far? Use a vector instruction to do these 8 additions with one instruction. So a broader add. So if we look at the desired assembly, this is what we really want it to look like. So our RAX will be the loop index, and currently it will be 0, but after this XOR. And we're going to use this vector instruction, vMove. And we will move from, basically this is an address operation, right? The offset of A plus the value of RAX will move from memory from that address into this register YMM0. And this is a vector register. It's a 256-bit wide vector register. And we are moving 256 bits from the array A, which is 8 integers. 256 divided by 32, it's 8. And we do the same for B. We move with the same instruction. This is assembly, but we're moving with the same instruction, the same vector instruction from offset B, same RAX, that's our loop index, into vector register YMM1. And next, we want to add them. So we want to add these two registers, right? We want to add the values from those two registers. So this is that operation right there. That's 256 bits of data, but it's added as if it's 32 bits 8 times. So it's not like we concatenate it all into one long value. We still do it correctly. And so we do that with this instruction, VP add, vector add, and now the names are, it only gets worse in terms of names. we and here notice we have three arguments. So these are the two arguments that we are actually going to be adding, and now we have one more, which is where we're going to be storing that, in which vector register. So we're taking vector register YMM1 and YMM0, we're adding them and we're storing it in YMM0. And we just did the addition, but we have to still store it back to memory. And that's what this other move instruction will do. vector move, our answer, so register vector register YMM0 is going to be stored back into that location in memory, which is A plus RAX. And then we increment, and notice how RAX, we don't increment by one or by you know, it's not our I used to be incremented by one by eight, right? Currently we do by 32, 32 is bytes. So we don't do 256 bits, we just say that's 32 bytes, that's our 256 bits. So we use now the RAX as an address index, kind of. So then the compare will also be with 2048, which I think was the size of the array, 512. Questions about how we just conquered the first vector instruction use for a two array addition? Seems clear, right? I thought it's much more complicated. Oh, yeah, go ahead. No, please.
So the 32 and 2048 are in bits, right?
Well, currently they're just numbers, right? They are just number values, but it represents 32 bytes. So each, well, 256 bits will be 32 bytes, but the idea is we are adding eight four bytes.
Why is comparing RX to 2048?
Yeah. So why is it comparing RX to so 512 times 4, I think.
Oh, because okay, got it.
Right.
So it's like 4 bytes per.
Yeah, number. 4 bytes per number. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So 8 became 32. Right. Yeah. Okay, so what does that look to have a visual of what we're actually doing? We have this arrays with, you know, somewhere in memory, and yeah, we're doing a vector move for both of them, for A and B, and we're basically going to be taking these values here, all these values, which is 256 bits, which is 32 bytes, right? And we'll be storing this in one vector register, and this one in another vector register. Then we'll use the vector add instruction and store that result in back into this vector register, and then later we can also write it back to memory. So that's the visual. Now, in terms of ALUs, or in terms of what happens in the processor, well, there are probably many ways to implement this kind of utility or action or behavior, but one way to do it is, and the common way to do it is that there are a lot of ALUs. So remember, we have our five-stage pipeline, or our out-of-order processor block diagram, and there were some ALUs. There was one ALU or two or much more many, like four. Well, now, imagine you have a sea of them, or not like an infinity, but still, you know, let's say 30 or 100 or 64 of these ALUs, and they are organized in lanes. So we mentioned how 32 bits, or let's go with 4 bytes. So 4 bytes, that's one int, and then another four bytes. They would these were the arguments to the function that we're actually adding. That's the real work we're doing. We're adding integers, right? We're adding 4-byte integers. So in this case, we're going to have 8 lanes. Each of the integers will take one lane, and the one ALU will do the addition of 2 integers, but since we have 8 of them in parallel, we're computing 8 additions at the same time. So that would be eight of these lanes. Yeah, and they will compute 8 additions of integers in parallel. And that's how the instruction will get executed. And they don't have to go in one clock cycle. Maybe an addition is something simple, it can go in one clock cycle, but You can also have a pipeline, have a pipeline. Let's say that there is a multiplication, a more complicated, takes longer, right, to multiply. So you cannot do that in one clock cycle. So you can split it in stages. That's why you have the stages here. And these are quite configurable. Imagine that you want to compute on longs, which are 8 bytes. Then you would perhaps group two of these lanes into one lane. So they are quite configurable. That they can do more work. It's not like they are dedicated only for integers. They are somewhat flexible to do the work of other operations as well. And they can do more operations, not just add. They can do multiply, many others. Not so much divide. Questions about this? So why are we using vector instructions? And it's really similar reasons with like unrolling, but yeah, it's even better, right? With unrolling, we have to fetch instructions. We have to do the branch prediction, and you know there is all this bookkeeping. There's a lot of. It's not really just bookkeeping. It's also how much is the logic when we unroll and we execute and we have. Think of the logic implementation on the processor, just. Managing to fetch a lot of instructions, to handle a more complicated branch prediction and all these other aspects, you might end up with more logic for just data management and instruction management than actually the ALU itself. So it turns out that with vector instructions, the control logic is much less, it's reduced. And basically the ratio of compute logic to control logic is higher. We do more useful work in terms of our hardware. It does more useful work. Yeah. So I guess it's also a cost thing. Yeah. So, right. And can it be done? Can we just write code in Python or Java or C and the compilers will take care of it? Is it automated? And it turns out that compilers are not that bad. They're quite smart and. Oftentimes, they actually figure it out, and they will automatically use vector instructions. But it's not always going to be successful. So if the compiler thinks, well, there might be a aliasing here. These are there are some vectors, some arrays, and they're pointers, and it's possible that there's aliasing between these pointers. Then the compiler will not automatically use vector instructions. Similarly, if there are conditionals, it's very we've seen how simple it was to just take 8 values and add all of them. What if we want to only add 7 out of them for more dynamic, more not so standard behavior? Then these conditionals can't really be taken care of by the compiler. So. Compiler will just give up, will just not use the vector instructions. Or there might simply be no operation. We're doing an operation, an arithmetic operation, or so that just is not there, is not supported with the vector instruction. So it's not very clear as a programmer which code will be compiled to use vector instructions and which will not. That's a bit unfortunate. If you write some C code, it's not really, you can't say, oh, this will 100% go to vector instructions and this other one not. It's somewhat unclear. Because in the end, it's kind of like a pattern, right? If you match a pattern that the compiler is comfortable with, it does it. So there is a way around it. And, it's basically called intrinsics. But let's look first at this example.
The slides are the same.
So in this example, we have two loops, and they're both similar, right? It's three nested loops, and it turns out that for the first one, the compiler will automatically compile it to use vector instructions. And for the second one, it could do the same in K, similar to how here it would do it in J. But For the second one, it simply didn't. So they are both, for both of them, it's possible to unroll and then use vector instructions. But the compiler was unable to do it for the second one. And no, it's not that trivial, because they both look somewhat identical or similar in terms of flow, data flow, and code flow, and so on. But that, this is just the motivation for the next aspect. So if the compiler can't do it automatically, and we really want it to be using the vector instructions, then we could, well, we could write the assembly. We've done that in the lab and in the homework, right? We could write the assembly by hand. But the other option is we could use these functions, the C and other languages as well, functions called intrinsic functions. And these functions, they will compile to particular instructions. So think of them as vector, so functions in C that will always compile to vector instructions. So yeah, it's just a like a library that will just always compile to vector instructions. So that's something you can use directly in C, which is great. So let's look again at this add example. We have the two arrays, and we have our loop. And the naming is the way it is. It's there is a reason for them. So MM stands for multimedia, and there's history behind. But yeah, the names you don't have to remember them. But you know, so in this line here, we are going to be loading 256 bits. Using this function, mm256 load u as i256. And we'll be storing those 256 in a variable called a values of this type, m256i, underscore m256i. And this is basically a variable that has 256 bits, or 32 bytes, and will store all those 8 values from A, 8 integers from A in the concatenated or in some way formatted together. And how do we pass A? We pass the address of A, I, so address of A at location I, and we cast it to this pointer type, to M256I pointer. We cast it to that. That's how we load from memory into our, in the end it will be into a local vector register, right? Questions about the first line? Similarly, we do it for B, nothing different. And then we add. So to add A values and B values, we use underscore mm256 underscore add, EPI 32. And this 32 means that it's 32-bit values inside. And we're going to store that into sums of that type. And then we want to store sums, our computed result, we want to store it back in A. So we'll use this store vector function, and we'll pass it the destination, which is our address of where A is, A of I is in memory, and we cast that to the pointer format, and we pass the value, sums. And sums will be 256 bits. Is this clear? It also works with the different sizes. So we just looked at int, and another example is to use long. Long would take 8 bytes. So in this case, we will be using the same 256 vector instructions of 256 of width of size 256. So that's why we will be incrementing by 4. So the loop variable will be incremented by 4. That's one of the differences. And another difference is that we'll be using a 64-bit add vector instruction. So it's a vector instruction that takes the entire 256, but the add is of 64-bit kind of chunks. Questions? And like we had the previous picture where we looked at the assembly and how the assembly was handling the data and the operations. In this case, we have both the assembly and the C intrinsics. So A and B, we loaded them with this functions, the C functions that are intrinsic functions. And we stored the result in A values and B values. And this will go into this vector registers. This is a separate register file. And then we will be using the vector addition, and we'll store it. It uses the VP add, but in C that looks like this intrinsic function. And then it gets stored into sum, and later we use the store function to write it back to memory. Questions?
So at a high level, we're just adding vectors together.
Yeah. With one instruction. Yeah. Vectors of 8 or 4, so 8 integers or 4 longs being added in one instruction. Yeah. So here's an exercise. So we're starting with two arrays, foo and bar, and they are of type long, and they're initialized to those values. And the program, so here's this C intrinsic functions, where we load foo and bar, and then we will do some arithmetic operation, and we will store the value back. And the question is, what will be the value of bar at the end? Because we're storing in bar. Take a few minutes, try to get comfortable with this C intrinsic function naming. had no malloc before. So this is a multiply. Yeah. Need more time? Almost done? Let's try to go for it. Should we? Maybe if you don't have it all the way finished, maybe we can just go for a guess. Who thinks it's A, B, C? What about C? D? No clue. Okay, let's look at it together. I also got C. So the first instruction here, foo 0 as vector. Okay, so we are doing a load, 256, but it's a long, so we're going to get only four of them, right? And we're starting from foo at 0. So foo at 0 starts there. And we will get, we will get values 1, 1, 2, and 2. And similarly, we're loading from foo at 4. Gonna be from over there, 3, 3, 4, 4. And we're also loading this bar 0 as vector. So we're loading from bar values. Starting from here, right, from 0, 2, 2, 2, 3. Okay. And here we're doing an add. So we're adding foo 0 with foo 4. So we'll be adding 1, 1, 2, 2 with, well, let me just write the answer. So 1 plus 3, 4. 1 plus 3, another 4. 2 plus 4, 6. 2 plus 4, 6. Hopefully I'm not making mistakes. So I just added this with this, right? Those two. And we're storing this in the result. And then we're doing a multiply of result with bar 0. So we're multiplying each of those with this 2, 2, 2, 3, right? So multiply with 2, 2, 2, 3. And we get 8, 12, and 18. And then so that's now currently in our result, and now we're using result here. We are storing it at bar 4. So we'll be storing them starting there. We'll be overwriting those values there, right? So in the end, we will have 2, 2, 2, 3, 8, 8, 12, 18. And it's, I mean, we did an addition and a multiplication with just two instructions, or four longs. We multiplied four longs and again four longs with just two instructions. So, well, and then plus load and store. So more than two instructions, but still. I thought I had the, okay, anyway. So let's see how we can use this vector instructions and the intrinsic, well, the C functions. Let's see how we can use them to do matrix multiplication. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we take four values because this is a 256 bit.
Oh, okay.
It can only take four 256 bits, and those are long of type long, which are 8 bytes, I think, 64 bits, right? So 256 divided by 64, 4.
Okay, thank you.
So we have here a matrix multiplication. It's a nested three loops nested and. Of three arrays, int A, int B, int C, unsigned, all of them. We don't have any cache blocking. We assume there's no aliasing and so on to avoid it, and everything should work. And one of the ways we can unroll this is unroll on in J. So we had J here and J here, right? So we can unroll that. And we do that. We increment J by 8, and we learn how to do this, and it maps quite well. Too much red. Maps quite well for the B array and also for the C. And just to highlight, we have a multiplication, and then we have a plus equal, so it accumulates into C of a certain index. That last loop in general. So similarly here, we will be having the multiplication and that plus equal. So far, questions? We've seen this before. Okay. Now, how to do this? So the goal is to do this with vector instructions. And notice that one of the challenges here is we don't have consecutive values from A. So A is not, doesn't even change with J, right? So A is always the same for this loop. It's a function of I and K in terms of index. So we want to use the same value. And previously, the previous instructions don't allow us to do that, right? Unless we somehow write in the memory an array that always has that value repeatedly. But there are, turns out that, you know, this instruction was clearly quite useful. So there is an instruction called set one, which will take one value and it will fill the vector with that value. It will broadcast that value. So in this case, it will load 8 copies of a 32-bit value into that 256-bit value. That's what the set one does. We've actually already used the multiply, but here it comes again. So the set will be using this broadcast instruction, so that this is the C intrinsic function, but then into assembly it will use the broadcast instruction, and then the multiply will use this VP mul D. Okay, so we want to vectorize this. We want to vectorize eight of these additions. So we have to, let's think a bit about it. We have to load B as a vector. We have to load C as a vector. We have to broadcast this value of A into a vector. And then we have to do the multiplication right there. And then we have to do this addition. So there are those, that sequence, right? And then we have to also store. Finally, we store the result. Um, So let's start little by little. So with C, we load the values of C, and we've seen how that's done. We use the load intrinsic function, and we pass it this address of C at that index. Similarly to store, same thing, just in reverse, we pass it a value over there, what we're storing. For B, similarly for B, right, we have it's incrementing by J, and we use the load, so nothing too different. Then for A, we are gonna use that set one. So we'll be broadcasting this value into a 256-bit vector. Oh, sorry, wait a second. There was also the multiply. So then we can multiply them. Yeah. Multiplying AIK with BKJ. So we're also doing the multiplication in this line. And this is gonna be stored in a variable called multiply results. So multiply results has, think about it now, all these C's, oh, only one of them, and we have now to add them to the previous ones from what I gather. So now we're gonna be taking the multiply results, and we'll be doing this accumulate, this plus equal. So we're doing this add with the Cij. And we're storing it on top of, well, also Cij. And then finally, we store Cij back into memory. And the entire code looks like that. So load C, load B, broadcast, load and broadcast A, then do the multiply of A times B, store it in this multiply results, added with the previous C, gives us the new C, and then we store C. Questions? It looks a bit scary, so many indexes and so on, but yeah, it does a good job. Yeah.
So the difference between load and set would be like load different values.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Set one. Set all those values to this one value. Yeah. That might be the wrong grammar to read, but I think that's how I interpret it. Okay. So here we have an exercise, another exercise. We have two loops, the ones above. We're adding B of I, B of index I. Well. We're multiplying B of index I with B of index J and then accumulating it into A of index I. Over there. Now, notice that it's the best to unroll this is not in J, but it's in I. So what we're doing here is we are unrolling it in I. So we're gonna be moving this I plus one, we'll be moving it to plus four. And then we're loading four A's, because this is a long. We're loading four A's and four B's, and we'll be doing the multiply and the add and the store and so on. So the question is, here are these two blanks. What should go in those blanks? Need more time? All right, let's try. So who thinks it's A, B, okay, C, D? Huh, you guys think it's B? So why do you think it's B? Who can say? Who wants to explain?
So I think trying to load like four long values into the BJ part, this vector, and since it is like the J keeps incrementing the indices, so like the values I load into BJ part will be different for every position. So that'll be load instead of set.
So you guys want to unroll. So we're already unrolling I, right? And you want to also do J, or you want, so in B, we have J plus equal 4, right? Here. So we would have, for J, we would go every 4. And then we load at B of J. I think we are gonna be missing about half of the numbers if we do that, or even more, half of the operations if we do that. So here is what at least we had in mind when we wanted to unroll on I. So the idea was that we're gonna increment I by 4, and then inside of, so we're not, yeah, and then inside of J in the second loop, we will have for each I, right, we have I plus 0, I plus 1, I plus 2, and I plus 3, we will have the same J. And if we have here also plus 4, then we're skipping the J plus 1 and J plus 2 and J plus 3. See what I mean?
Yeah, but I was like, on the previous slide, I was thinking about like, if I only load one value with MM256, that would be like this.
Here?
Yeah, so like, there would be only one value.
So my answer was C, and the way I was doing it, well, first I would increment only by 1, and then I would broadcast the value of B of index J to the whole vector so that I can use that value for all the A's, because I have A of, let's say, I plus 0, but they also have I plus 1, I plus 2, and I plus 3, and they all need to use B of index J, all of them. And if we, because I think what you guys are doing, if you do that, you're going to give to the next one B of J plus 1. If you load with this, intrinsic function, then you will load consecutive values of B, and then you will use those. You will use those in here, meaning. You would be multiplying B of I plus 1. So this B here has to be, it's not A, it's B, right? Because we have BI times BJ. So you would be multiplying B of all these indexes with B of also all those indices, but it will be with J. But what we want is to multiply B of all these indices, I plus something, with the same BJ. B of J. So that's why B is incorrect. While C, we have the J plus one, and then we broadcast that value of B, just as explained in this slide. We have J plus one, but then we broadcast this B of index J to the whole vector, and then we multiply that vector to this other vector, B of I plus these four consecutive values.
What does the prefix EPI?
This one?
Yeah.
I think it specifies that it's going to be a 64-bit. So the multiplication is a 64-bit multiplier. So we have longs. If it's EPI 32, then it will be 32-bit. But what does EPI exactly stand for? Charles, do you know?
For EPI stands for, so it used to be EPI, and then it was packed integers.
Packed integers. Packed integers, packed integers of type 64 or of 32-bit, packed 32-bit integers, packed 64-bit integers.
Okay, then if BJ part is 64-bit and BI part is 256-bit, like how this multiplication is?
So this is 256, and this is also 256. BJ part, where does it come from? It comes from, well, BI part loads that. BJ part is a result of another 256-bit something, right? Set one. Yeah.
So that's like put four BJ into this.
Yes. Puts four values of the, go ahead. Yeah. Flipped. What do you mean flipped?
Like you're doing A of, you're doing the interloop basically AFJ plus equals
BFJ. So I'm really doing this, right?
Right. Because
right? I'm doing this. So I'm incrementing by four, but then inside of J I'm using all the I values, all the I indexes. Right? Yeah. And then B of index J has to be broadcast, and then we can do the vector. Okay. Yeah, let's keep moving a little bit, time. So it, sometimes it's challenging. The values currently were always the way we wanted them to be, in the right order. If you want to change the order, you could manipulate it with some operations, or there are actually instructions to manipulate the order in a vector. The instructions to shuffle things around. I don't want to spend time on that, but there are these instructions called permutate, and they take as an argument an order like that's formatted something like this. And you don't have to. You have to read the documentation every time you want to use this. So vector instructions, they didn't just arrive yesterday. You know, there was an evolution of them. So first, they were 128-bit in size, and they were called SSE and so on, and a couple of versions or iterations of those 128-bit vectors. And then currently, the ones we looked at, the AVX ones, are 256-bit. There is also the 512, AVX 512-bit. And what's interesting is that we didn't just abandon the previous ones and just move to the new ones. We kept the old ones as well. So it's compatible with the old legacy code. So in x86, in the Intel and AMD processors, you have several types of vector instructions. There is a 128, there is 256. I think our machines don't have 512, so we won't be using the 512 bit. This is a very, I think we all agree that vector instructions are quite high throughput or higher throughput. They are useful and they makes sense to have them, so every single processor architecture also has them. ARM has the Neon, they call it like that, and other instructions also have it. And the last remark that is quite exciting, I guess, is that GPUs are essentially very large cores that mostly are focused on vector operations. They are mostly vector instructions. They are just, when you use a GPU, you only want to do vector instruction workloads and arithmetics and so on. And it's not the only reason why their GPUs are high performance and very fast and do high throughput of arithmetic computation. There are other optimizations like memory and peripheries and just other ideas as well, not only this vector principle, but this is the nature. This is how I guess you could say started. This is at the core of the GPU, fundamental idea of the GPU is that they are very large vector instruction specialized CPUs. Yeah. Now, when you want to... Oh, you have a question. Please, yes. So we did the work of 8 instructions in one, right? That's like the most trivial part, right? We had one instruction that replaced 8 additions or 8 multiplications. We did 8 multiplications with only one instruction, one vector instruction. So that's like the trivial part. But then there's other things. If you think of what's happening in the processor, you will have 8 instructions. They might be parallelizable, so you'll have to fetch all of them. So there will have to be some fetch logic that is very, capable. And then you have to look in those 8. Is there any, are there any branches? Are there any dependencies? Because they are not compiled to be. They're just instructions. I mean, when you compile your application into one instruction, it's just one instruction. It's easy. But then if it's 8 separate independent instructions, then your processor has to process them independently, right? Is there any dependency between these 8? So it has to actually look at each of them and treat each instruction separately. Are there any dependencies? Are there any branches? Should we do branch predictions? Is there aliasing or... then we'll have to go to the instruction to issue them, right? And then how they map to the ALUs and so on. There is more control to handle 8 independent instructions because, when you have a program and you have 8 ads one after another, it's not like you can treat those 8 as, this is one. It's just 8 instructions. The processor doesn't know that those are related. It will still have to look for dependencies and so on. So it has to do a lot of control, a lot of just management of these instructions. So that's like the branch prediction, the aliasing, the issue the instructions, and those register renamings. All of those things we looked at, right? All of that stuff has to happen. While now, when you have vector instructions, it's one block. It's one instruction. That's just treated as a macro, as a chunk. So it's simpler in terms of what's going on the processor.
So it's simpler for the processor, yeah. And it's also simpler for us to code because it's just one instruction?
Well, I would say to code maybe a bit more effort on our end because, you see, we have to actually identify these 8 instructions. I think it's a bit more complicated on our end. The compiler won't just do it automatically all the time, so we have to use these intrinsic functions. But for the processor, it's definitely much easier to run one instruction than to run 8 of them. Yeah. When we want to optimize a workload, you could, there are different ways people usually do this. You could start looking at the code and identify by reading at the code, maybe there are some things that are slow. But that's right, that's the worst thing you can do. Like, you're not gonna be efficient in that. Or maybe you will instinctively think, well, I guess there is this Fourier transform or something, let me try to make this faster. But what you should really do is, you should measure, you should run your program and profile it. You should look into which parts of my program are actually slow. So the idea is that you have to spend effort where it matters. Identify what is the slowest, what is really slowing down your program, and then try to make that faster. And I also put on this slide that Amdahl's law is very related to this. It says it with beautiful words, right? The overall performance improvement gained by optimizing a single part of a system is limited by the fraction of time that the improved part is actually used. So the idea is take something that takes a long time, find the part that takes a larger fraction of time and try to optimize that, make that faster. And you do that with a profiler. And a profiler is a tool, there are many of them, but in Linux, for example, there is one called perf. And you can run a binary and you can see, it ran for, let's say, 100 seconds and it spent this many seconds in this function, this other many seconds in this function, and so on. So it gives you a picture of how slow each part of your program is. And we all ran an HCLRS, and Charles put this figure on the slide that actually profiles our HCLRS. And for example, there is this line here that is the function hash brown map make hash. And this function takes 23% self of the time. The program is in this function itself about 23% of the time, and it's 41% of the time in this function and functions that this function calls. So that's what children stands for. So, or the above it, there is this other function, spend expression evaluate, that's 31%. So if we make this 31% or this 23%, cut it in half, then we're gonna improve our overall latency or overall speed somewhat. That half times how much it was actually taking, and that would be like our incremental improvement. And so that's how a profile can be useful. Now, if we run an empty while loop, and this is on a single core, and what am I trying to get with this is, I want to try to motivate exceptions and operating system. So, think that you have an embedded system with no operating system, and you run just this, in assembly, this would be like main, jump to main or so. And it would just be one instruction program that always does that. So your processor will be overloaded with just this one instruction in the whole pipeline. There's nothing else you can do, right? And now imagine that you're trying to SSH into this machine. It's only one core, and it does this. So yeah, our SSH request will just be ignored because the processor is never able to take anything else. And now imagine that any of us could run this, like such a simple code, right? Any of us could just run this on a machine and make the machine unavailable to everyone, or the entire cloud, right? Malicious person would just run this code in the cloud, and all of a sudden, all internet will fall down. So, of course, this is not going to be desirable, or this has to be prevented. A more complicated time is a more complicated, or not complicated, like a more a better picture is in this code. The idea here is that we don't do nothing; we actually first measure the time. So we measure the clock tick. basically we are going, this function will give us a number, and that number will be the clock tick, and then this other one will give us another clock tick. And there will be some interval between them. And ideally, this interval should be constant, because there is nothing going on. And yeah, this is how we compute the interval. When we run this on an embedded system without operating system, with just this, like bare metal, we're probably going to see a very constant interval. The same, maybe two or three or four clock cycles, the same number. But when we run this on a server machine, most of the time we get that constant, but some other times we get these spikes, and some of them are very large spikes. And that is because there are other things running on the operating system. There are other things on that machine, other programs. So we would like to be able to run in parallel different programs. So they have to share the processor. Different programs have to share a processor, right, in terms of time, so time multiplexing. And to do that, there has to be an arbiter. You could think of it as an arbiter, or as a task scheduler. And that is what we refer to as an operating system. These programs, they will have in between them these other programs, other management or arbiter instructions, mini programs, operating system programs that will handle when a program ends, maybe another one begins, and so on. Or it handles exceptions, handles interrupts. So let's say there is our loop, and then from the network is a hardware interface, there is a packet arrives, because the network has an IP address, and the server, the internet decided that, well, you are the guy with the IP address that must receive this packet. This is for you. So the processor will receive an interrupt from the network card. And then that interrupt is something we call an exception. So the operating system will have a routine called exception handler. And you can think of it as a routine that always runs in parallel. And how does it run in parallel? I mean, we have five pipeline stages or more or less, but we have pipeline stages in a processor, and it's always running that loop. So how does the processor do this? You know, handle it, have a routine, an exception handler. You know, where does it fit? So it turns out there is dedicated hardware that allows the processor. So there's special hardware in parallel with the core just for that. Hardware for the operating system to be able to process these exceptions, these interrupts. And then when an exception arrives, what it will do is it will switch context. It will stall, so it will stop one of the programs. And what does that mean? There is a register file that has values, such as the stack pointer and all these other values, right? There is the condition codes. So it will copy all of those into memory, and it will override them with something else, and then it will resume the execution. So that's how we switch context. Starts running this thing. And this, the mechanisms for that is exceptions. We would like to be able to basically save the old program, the counter, the registers, the condition codes into memory, and then load new ones for the new program. Load the ones for the new program. That's basically what we do to switch context. There's also an image for it. There we go. So in the CPU, we have our registers, the ones here in blue, in a purple. And these registers and the condition codes and program counter right there, they are all what matters to run this process A. this program here. Now, if we want to load a different program, in memory, the operating system has already these values ready, so the register file values and in order to start that program. So if an exception is to arrive, it can override the processor register files and all those other values with the other with these values here. And you know, resume runtime. And if you do that, we switch from one program to another. And this can happen a lot. Every single, after every few clock cycles, we can switch context if we have to. Questions about so far? Now, another question would be if a program, so here we have two programs, and in program A, we have this value 42. We are moving this value 1000 into RAX, while in program B, we are moving a 99 into RAX. So the question here is, when we look at these addresses for program A and program B, are these programs writing and reading values in the memory space of the other program? Do they share the same memory space? And if they do, is that safe? Ideally, what would be RAX? So because this is physical memory, the programs are attempting. So program B is attempting to use this address and that address is where the program A has some content, right? And there is protection for memory, well, as the slide also suggests. So this will not be allowed. So the program A will correctly run, will not be hacked or damaged, while program B will fail to run. It might crash. So we'll look at this in more detail next time. We'll look at exceptions in more detail next time.